I'm not sure journalists have or ought to have that much influence, but there you are. I'll take the compliment.
Well,
how are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to hear your voice, a very distinctive one, and a face that we've come to know. And George's column appears regularly in the newspaper of record, the Advocate-Picayune in Louisiana. And you won your Pulitzer in 1977, and there's nothing wrong with longevity. It is a different world than it was when Jimmy Carter was in office, 44 years ago?
It sure is. And one of the pleasures, I'm not sure what the second one is, but one pleasure of turning 80 is you look back and you say, what was it that had me in such a lather during the Carter administration? Some of what looked like peak issues get eroded in memory, get flattened out.
Well, in retrospect, he is a statesman. I obviously am not as conservative as you, but I don't regard Carter as a great president, but I do regard him as a great former president. And over time, based on recent performances in the Oval Office, he doesn't go down in history as one of the worst ever, I don't think.
I think you're right. Remember what Henry Adams said? That he said that the evolution of presidents from Washington through Grant disproved the theory of evolution. in a way, I think in one of the points of my new book is to get us to focus a little bit less on presidents particularly, but on politics in general, because I'm a firm believer in the proposition that politics is downstream from culture. And there are cultural developments in the country that I write more about and alarm me more, even more than the political developments.
Well, you are a student of pop culture as well, and some of your best columns, and they're all good, but some of your best columns are about people who are not in politics. One a few years ago on the 100th anniversary of Frank Sinatra, I've clipped. It is one of the best columns I've ever read about the chairman of the board, and I think he's mentioned in your book.
He is. I have columns on Bob Dylan, the Beach Boys, and Sinatra. On Sinatra, I said, if you want to see the decline and fall of things, compare a Sinatra lyric such as "The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea" with "I can't get no satisfaction." Which is better? Come on.
What was it? Pete Hamill wrote a book, Why Sinatra Matters. And for those of us of an age, and I'm, 17 years younger than you, so I'm a seasoned citizen as well, Sinatra matters.
And what interests me about the Beach Boys on their 50th, these are boys, mind you, on their 50th anniversary tour, was how much the baby boomers' nostalgia is cued by popular music. It's extraordinary. I wrote about Dylan because I wanted to explore why he was given the Nobel Prize for Literature. And my friend, distinguished American historian at Princeton, Sean Wilentz, had written a whole book about Dylan, so I read it and got kind of convinced. I also liked the fact that Dylan once said his favorite politician was Barry Goldwater, for whom I cast my first presidential vote.
That's interesting. That's 1964. 18-year-olds didn't have the right to vote at that time, and you cast your vote for Barry Goldwater over Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Louisiana went overwhelmingly for Barry Goldwater, despite the fact that it was, and for another generation, was a blue state. But the South now is solid Republican territory, and let's face it, it's Trump territory. How do you explain that phenomenon?
Well, there's, as you know, a strong populist tendency in the South, most particularly in Louisiana, where Huey Long, every man a king, Huey Long created, I think it's fair to say, I don't want to insult his memory any more than necessary, something akin to a police state. So first there's that. Then there's the sense that I think the South tends to have a kind of geographical truculence about its relationship with the condescending North and coastal elites. So Donald Trump, with his feral cunning, exploited this, among other anxieties and resentments.
Well, he did, and he does. He's got a rally coming up in Georgia, the only southern state he lost in two elections. And in the SEC, with the 11 states that are represented, he won every one of them twice, except for Georgia, where he lost by an extremely close margin, about 11,000 votes. But he did lose Georgia, despite his protestations to the contrary. Do you think he's over and done, or is there still could he be the next Grover Cleveland?
Well, I'm trying to guard against allowing my wishes to be the father of my thoughts, but I do think he's apt to be done. He's an entertainer, and I'm not sure how entertaining he is anymore. He has one pedal on the organ. He's worked it for 30 years with a few minor changes. It used to be Japan was going to eat our lunch. Now it's the Chinese who are doing so. But my feeling is we might be rescued by the great, wonderful human capacity for boredom. He's an entertainer, and an entertainer can't be predictable, and he has to change his act now and again, and I see no change in this. You mentioned the SEC. I think there is in my book, I think I put the column in there, I say, look, you want to see how much America's changed, go to an SEC football game, LSU against Alabama, for example. And you look down on the field, and the head referee is an African-American, and he's bossing everyone around. And he's penalizing people, and no one cares about his race. Now, 60 years ago, you couldn't play in the SEC if you were an African-American. So people who try to say that America is, A, founded in sin, and B, has not made measurable improvement are wrong twice.
There is improvement, and there is no doubt, although there are some who don't like the fact that 85% of the players on LSU's team are African-American. And that, as you stated, is a change. 50 years ago, zero. But it's a change for the better, and one that I think has opened doors for black people and other walks of life. But you, a listener, Bill Bryan, says, you say SEC football is probably the last religion left in America.
The last established religion, yes. I think that's true, which is why the change in the racial composition, both of officials and players, is a good metric of how we've done.
It is indeed. And of course, another listener notes your passion for baseball. It's been 31 years, hard to believe, since you wrote Men at Work, along with Ball 4, the best-selling baseball books of all time. And your passion for baseball is such that you have written that Baltimore is the best baseball town in America. The Orioles are having a rough year, but it is a great baseball town, isn't it?
It certainly is. Often, towns like Kansas City and Cincinnati and this year, Milwaukee is the smallest market in baseball, are small enough that the baseball team really gets woven into the fabric of the community in a way that it doesn't in Los Angeles or New York.
Many may not know that George Will grew up in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. His father was a professor at the university. And I think at one time, and perhaps still so, you were a passionate Cubs fan.
I still am, yes. Growing up in Champaign, I grew up midway between Chicago and St. Louis. And at an age too tender to make life-shaping decisions, I had to choose between being a Cub fan and a Cardinal fan. All my friends became Cardinal fans and grew up cheerful and liberal. And I became a Cub fan and became a gloomy conservative. I blame it all on baseball.
Well, when you go to Wrigley Field or Fenway Park, they're kind of the last bastions of the way it used to be.
Absolutely.
And baseball, Larry King called it athletic chess. Is that why you like it?
I like it for a lot of reasons, the main one of which is it's the most severe meritocracy. That is, you play 162 games in 183 days. You are your record. At the end of the year, you can't say, we're better than this. No, you're just exactly what your record says you are. It's also the perfect game for democracy, because democracy is a system of the half loaf. No one gets everything they want. Every team goes to spring training essentially knowing it's going to win 60 games and going to lose 60 games. You play the whole season to sort out the middle 42 games. And if you win 10 out of 20 games, you're definitionally mediocre. If you win 11 out of 20 games, you might play in October.
There you go. Well, hang tight. We're going to take a 90-second break and return with George Will, his latest book, American Happiness and Discontents, about the 21st century. We're back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing in a few more minutes with the remarkable George F. Will. His latest work, American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008 to 2020. 2008 was the year that Barack Obama was elected president. 2020 was the year that Joe Biden was elected. And in between, we had Donald John Trump. And George Will, I think in 2016... you became an independent. What was the catalyst for that?
On June 2nd, 2016, my friend Paul Ryan, cheerful, intelligent, the model of what we ought to have in politics, endorsed Donald Trump. And I said, if someone as wise and good as Paul Ryan thinks they can normalize this man in the Republican Party, I'm out of here. So the next morning, I came in and changed my registration. So it's been more than 5 years, and I really don't miss it. Because politics is important, but it's not all important. In fact, I'm a firm believer in the axiom that politics is downstream from culture, and that cultural changes are undercovered, underwritten about in journalism. I was actually surprised when I put this book together how often I write about parenting, and how often what I write about parenting feeds into another thing I write a lot about, which is the lunacy going on college campuses these days. I'm absolutely convinced that the way we parent now, isn't it interesting that parent used to be a noun and now it's a verb? And the way we parent now encourages the idea of parental determinism, that if you're sufficiently skillful as a parent, you can produce these awesome children. The problem is what you actually produce by hovering over them all the time and supervising their every move is risk-averse children, bubble-wrapped children. And they wind up, they get to college, and all of a sudden they want safe spaces. They don't want freedom of speech. They want freedom from speech that might disturb their brittle sensibilities. And what happens on campus doesn't stay on campus. This kind of sensitivity permeates the whole society. So you get a kind of madness everywhere, which is quite disturbing.
Well, we're seeing this in the political environment as well, in which both sides of the spectrum, the major parties, can't stand dissent. And, George, I love you, and I enjoyed you when you were a solid voice on the conservative side. I enjoy you now when you are saying words that need to be said about former President Trump. But I think you're on MSNBC a lot exactly because of that. If you were a Trump supporter, you would not be given an audience there. What do you think of that?
Well, there's really not a place for me in the cable television world right now. But, you know, that's all right. There are 331 million people in this country. At any given moment, about 325 million of them are not watching cable television. They're getting on with life. They're cleaning the gutters, fixing the screen door, raising children. And for the vast majority of Americans, politics is a peripheral and occasional distraction, and that's a sign of national health.
But we did have great turnout last year. We did. And what do you attribute that to?
The fact, and this is not a sign of national health, the fact that for far too many people, the pursuit of happiness, we're the only nation in the world founded on such a good idea. Today, the pursuit of happiness has been distorted because the happiness of a great many people boils down to the unhappiness of the other team. We're only happy when they're unhappy. And a large number of Americans are only happy when they themselves are unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, there was a radio show called Fibber McGee and Molly.
Yes.
And Molly would say of her husband, Fibber, he says, look, if it makes you happy to be unhappy, then be unhappy. And there are a lot of Americans who only feel alive if they're constantly furious about something. And as a result, we go from one synthetic hysteria to another. Right today in Washington, there is a fence been put back up, an obscenity around our Capitol building, because some lunatics are coming to town to have a little rally in support of those who committed the January 6th riot at the Capitol. That fence communicates to the world a falsehood, a libel, that we are a fragile country, that our institutions are in danger. It makes us look like a banana republic, nervous about a restive infantry regiment at the edge of town. It's just, it's a scandal that we allow our security hysteria to produce prophylactic measures like this.
Now, earlier you reflected on Barry Goldwater, and you were a close friend of Ronald Reagan, who was the keynote speaker in 1964 when Goldwater received the Republican nomination. These were men with manners, elegant fellows who the other side would admire, even though they didn't like their politics. Trump, of course, is a man who is not in that realm. He is he's a person who ruffles feathers and takes great joy in doing it. But some would say the line in the Republican Party, it started with Goldwater, continued under Reagan, and Trump was a natural manifestation of that. My guess is that you would disagree. But what are your thoughts about those who believe that?
Well, I think they ought to go back and revisit Barry and Ronald Reagan. When Barry first went into politics, running for the City Council of Phoenix in 1948, he wrote a letter to his brother and said of politics, "It ain't for life and it might be fun." Barry had fun. Ronald Reagan was famously congenial and smiling. These are people who said this is not a blood sport. This is a hard competitive business, but at the end of the day, you can sit down with Tip O'Neill, as Reagan did, and have some Irish whiskey. It doesn't need to be like this. It doesn't need to be the kind of snarl that is the constant emission from the Prince of Mar-a-Lago. And today we have this weird Republican Party in which a great many of its elected officials live in terror of their voters, because they know that some sulfuric belch from Mar-a-Lago can turn 30-40% of their voters against them. Now, if you're afraid of your voters, it means you don't much like them. And if you don't much like them, it means you don't really respect them, which is a very peculiar position for the Republican Party to be in.
All right. The book is American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008-2020, from George F. Will. And another listener notes that the Republican Party is beholden to the evangelical wing of its party, and that often they have the loudest voice and maybe the most influential position within the party. And does that disturb you?
It certainly does. One of the casualties of the nomination and election of Donald Trump is the credibility of the evangelical community, which for years said, and rightly said, character counts. The moral tone set by the president matters. Well, I don't think so. We can't believe that they believe this after they elected president the man who shortly before the election was heard on the Access Hollywood tape. Enough said.
Now you, George Frederick Will, I think you were a religious studies major at Trinity College, and you have evolved. Is it fair to say you were an agnostic?
Actually, I've described myself as an amiable, low-voltage atheist. I have no theism. That's what atheist means. Always have been, frankly. I came from a very secular upbringing. My grandfather on my father's side was a Lutheran minister, and my father would sit outside, as a young boy, would sit outside Pastor Will's study in Pennsylvania and listen to the pastor and some of his congregants trying to reconcile the doctrine of grace and free will, and he got interested in philosophy and became a professor of philosophy for almost 40 years. But I'm not trying to convert anyone. I'm married to a ferocious Presbyterian. So, as I say, amiable, low voltage.
And a man who calls it as he sees it and has been successful as an individual, and that's the way it should be in our country. The book is American Happiness and Discontents, from a man who has seen it all over the last half century. This one focuses on his work over the last dozen years, 2008 to 2020, The Unruly Torrent. George Will, it has been a pleasure. Thank you, sir, and keep going.
I've enjoyed it, and I intend to. Thank you very much.
Good to visit with you.
Bye.
Bye. And we'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this quick timeout for the news. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org. And we're joined now by Dr. Josh Darr of LSU, and he has posed a question and has actually done some research that is relevant about what happens when a newspaper's opinion page ignores national politics. Good morning to you, Dr. Darr.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
What did you find?
Yeah, we tracked an experiment that a local newspaper in California did where they decided not to have any syndicated columnists like George Will or letters to the editor about the president or really any national politics on their opinion page for a month. And what we found was that opened up a lot of space. About a third of the opinion page was devoted to national politics before this experiment, and that local issues filled that space. So traffic and infrastructure and local organizations were talked about more, and polarization fell. So people were less far apart from each other politically than in a comparison community that we measured.
Well, some people, of course, including yours truly, believe you can have both. You can have local and national profiles in a newspaper or on a radio show like this. But you're saying that your research finds that, and when we're talking about newspapers, that when local content is accented, there is more local stimulation. Is that fair?
Yes, and that local stimulation sort of de-emphasizes political parties while, you know, making sure that people are focusing on the things that bring them together in a community, that local identity. So it's not that, you know, you get rid of politics. We didn't find that there was no mention of Democrats or Republicans. We found that there was substantially less, and that there was a focus on maybe issues that emphasized that local identity over partisanship.
And as far as the interest in local matters, is this a case in which the people who consume newspapers are driving the train, or are they just being influenced by them?
I think there is still a demand for local news. I just think that the supply is increasingly not meeting it because there's such a temptation to skew national and get a national audience now that it's so technologically easy to reach so many people. And so I think local news organizations are struggling with this, of what that balance is and how they can distinguish themselves in a marketplace that is simply saturated with national news. But I do think people still want to know the sort of instrumental stuff that's going on in their community that helps them live their everyday lives in that community.
877-217-5757 from Dr. Josh Darr, who poses the question, what happens when a newspaper's opinion page ignores national politics? New research finds more local news can help bring people together. Now, some people would say, look, Dr. Darr, when you have people who are speaking and writing in passionate terms about issues, that it does just the opposite, that it divides people. How do you answer that?
So I think, you know, we don't want to make sure people aren't passionate about what they're writing about, but if that's a local issue, I think it's different than if it's a faraway national issue that's pitted away, you know, as one party against the other. Local issues tend to be a little more jumbled up in terms of the partisanship of it. And partisan identity is such an important driver of behavior and opinion these days. So many other identities are fitting under that national political party umbrella that people have, that I think just simply shifting the focus to local things helps undercut that a bit and find areas of agreement that people might not see if they are less open to what national parties are giving them.
Now, Josh Darr, who is an assistant professor of political communication at LSU, got this idea when you had a Google alert. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we'd published a study that showed that when a local newspaper closes, the polarization goes up. And this local newspaper, the Desert Sun, out in Palm Springs, California, saw it and said they were going to do this experiment. but they didn't consult us first. They just wrote about it, and so our names appeared in the op-ed announcing it, and we had to drop everything else we were doing and scramble to get this study together that formed the basis for the book. We had about 3 weeks to do it.
Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, you're on the air with Dr. Darr. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Dr. Darr, I got a question. I like to comment to, newspaper when you read them online, newspaper articles. And I noticed, like our local paper, they made it real hard to comment. You can't really even see the comment section anymore. I was wondering if you could talk about that. Like, do comment sections help or do they hinder, in your opinion?
It's a good question. Yeah, I think comment sections are tricky business for newspapers because they often want to moderate them, which takes resources that they don't necessarily have. And what we found with this was that it took a lot of attention from a dedicated opinion editor, which is something that's often a luxury for newspapers to have these days, to really make this experiment work. And I'd imagine a comment section works the same. So if you have the resources to moderate a comment section, it can be really good. If you don't, you either have sort of the Wild West in your comments or you just want to get rid of them completely because it's simpler.
In many areas of this country, local newspapers are like dinosaurs. They're going away. And we're fortunate that we have a printed version of The Advocate every day of the week, but that's not the case everywhere, as you know. And what is that doing, the fact that in some cases there are no local newspapers remaining?
It's a very serious problem. There's so much evidence in economics and political science in all these fields that shows that government just works better when there's a local newspaper. Not only our findings about polarization, but everything from pollution levels to municipal bond prices are better when there's a vibrant local newspaper in a community, and other local media sources are part of that as well. So if we lose local newspapers, we're not only losing government capacity alongside it, we're contributing to this nationalization of politics where, absent local considerations, people are just going to think politics is about what the Democrats and the Republicans in Washington are doing, not about the government decisions that affect their own communities.
Are there areas of the country, based on your findings, Dr. Darr, where people are more interested in local issues, or is that a universal trend? After all, it was Tip O'Neill, who George Will mentioned, who said all politics is local.
Yes, I like Tip O'Neill, went to Boston College, so that's a quote that I hold close to my heart. I think that most people are very interested in their local communities, and I think that demand is still there. But the supply is not meeting it, and that's because of economic factors. Of, you know, print ads got more for papers than online ads, and Facebook and Google are sweeping up the money from these online ads that are based on the content that local news is providing. So the economic model is not there, but I don't think there's any less interest in what's going on in your local government that's affecting your taxes, your kids' schools, your local programs. I think that's still there.
What do you see as the future of newspapers in this country, independent of whether the coverage is local or national? Will 10 years from now, for example, will The Advocate still be printing on a daily basis? Do you think that will be the case?
I think it's a very open question. I think that there needs to be some sort of adaptation. I think that the value of a printed newspaper is very real. It's this bundle of all these things you want that arrives on your doorstep that you consume as a whole. It's a very valuable product, but it doesn't seem like the viability of that is necessarily going to be there. So, you know, maybe it's a newsletter-based model. I know Substack is experimenting with local outlets. Maybe it's more of a nonprofit news model that is distributed online. I know that talk radio is going to be a part of it. I know that local radio is a very important local news source as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something like The Advocate that's doing pretty well, I would say, in 10 years might be, but COVID accelerated a very clear downward trend in local newspapers, and so something's going to have to happen to bounce that back up, because right now the trajectory is clear and it's downward.
A listener asked, it's a question that's not really related to local or national, but whether it is local or national, is it important to present various points of view rather than a monolithic point of view?
Yes, absolutely, and that's really one of the great things about the opinion page, is that it can be that. It's it's the laced professional part of the newspaper. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to be journalists. It can be people writing in about things that they're involved with and that they're passionate about. And, you know, it can be edited for grammar and content, but it's not filtered necessarily. I think newspapers really want to use that page, or at least they should, to present a range of views. So, you know, people expressing themselves through that community forum, it has a lot of potential for that. But if it's just nationally syndicated columnists, all respect to our previous guest, then it can't serve as that.
Dominic in Grand Coteau, you're on with Joshua Dar. Hi, Dominic.
Good morning, man. I was in the newspaper business for 40 years, and I think that part of the decline came when, newspapers throughout history have always made money through the wars, the depression. They always were in the black, you know, maybe not so much, but they always were in the black. And I think that shareholders, people not even associated with newspaper business, these kind of people, you know, got involved and bought the papers for profit and didn't realize that it takes the guy to address comments in a comment section. It takes a person talking to somebody about their obituary, and they've cut back so they.
All right. Thank you, Dominic. Would you respond, Dr. Dar?
Absolutely. He's right about the ownership. More than half of Americans now read a newspaper owned by a hedge fund. And they're just not going to have the values needed to keep up the local character of a newspaper. They're looking to do hedge fund things, which is, you know, raise revenues and cut costs at every possibility. And so the cost-benefit structure of owning a newspaper depends on who owns it. And if it's hedge funds instead of local owners, as you know we have with The Advocate, then they're going to get different outcomes, and those are generally not going to be good for getting local information to people, which probably should be the goal.
Well, Dr. Joshua Dar, thank you for joining us. You know your stuff about print media and the newspapers, and we'll be calling on you again soon. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Jim.
877-217-5757. We'll switch gears and turn the page, and we'll talk about the loss of a Louisiana politico of note, Vincent Bruno, who has died of coronavirus, age 75, a man who didn't believe in vaccines, but was a passionate voice for our state. We'll talk about it when we return. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing your number, 877-217-5757. And for those who've listened to our show for a few years, one of our guests, usually once or twice a year, was Vincent Bruno, and longtime member of the Republican Central Committee. Spent his career with the New Orleans Police Force, was head of the police union when the officers went on strike in 1979 and suspended Mardi Gras, nephew of Carlos Marcello. Talk about a man who had a full life, and that life ended a few days ago as he expired at the age of 75, a victim of coronavirus. And with us to talk about his friend and ours, Major Bobby Ragsdale, a young man who Vincent introduced me to, and Vincent said, "This guy's going places, Jim. You need to meet him." And as I mentioned, Bobby was student body president at Newman in New Orleans, and then he was head of his class at West Point, and then vice president of his class at Harvard in grad school, and he is back home. And I know Vincent Bruno had a big impact on your life, Major Ragsdale.
He sure did. He kind of took me in under his wing when I had come off active duty about 3 years ago after 15 years on active duty. And, you know, Vincent had always been kind of a presence in my life as a lot of the older guard of policemen were. You know, my grandfather was chief deputy at JPSO. And a lot of all of his old hangarounds became my old hangarounds. And when I came back into the city, Vincent just immediately took me under his wing and said, you know, hey, there's a lot of people in this town that you need to meet. And one of them is Jim Inkster. So I thank him for that introduction. And he was just a good friend. You know, we would go to things together, drive up to Baton Rouge all the time. I'd go pick him up in my car, and we'd drive up to Baton Rouge for the inauguration or, you know, this thing or that thing. And he was just, my kids loved him. You know, he was a grandpa, and would just come around and play with him. Great guy. He is sorely missed.
He is indeed, and he was a rare person, and I've mentioned this from both sides in the political spectrum, that it's human nature that we hang out with people who agree with us. But Vincent took great pleasure in jousting with people who disagreed with him, and he did not take it personally.
Yeah, you know, Vincent and I were different breeds in many respects, like you and him, I'm sure. We were of the same party, but we still had plenty of disagreements over the way things were being run, and he'd love nothing more. And sometimes it would make other people, I think, in the room uncomfortable if they didn't understand that he enjoyed it, that he could have these arguments, and he would get, you know, he would, I don't know, it was all an act, but he would get kind of hot and bothered, you know, he would get excited, and but that was his way of expressing himself, and it was like a pleasure. It was like a boxer or you know, a professional fighter, an athlete. Like, he loved stepping into the ring. The hits didn't bother him. Mm-hmm. That was what he came for, and it was just, you know, he and I are of the same cut in that way, I suppose. You know, we just enjoy a good rhetorical tussle, and so I, you know, I appreciated his willingness to engage on that level.
And Vincent, he was a close friend and associate of David Treen, the former governor. And when Treen ran for Congress in 1999 and lost a cliffhanger to David Vitter by fewer than 1,000 votes, Vincent went to Dave Treen and said, "Look, I've got this guy dead to rights. He's seeing prostitutes. He goes to Dauphine and Dumaine on a regular basis and meets with a prostitute." And Dave Treen says, "We don't play that way. We're not doing it." And that cost Dave Treen an election. And then Vincent went on the air with me after the election and said what was true and was denied, and then was later exposed in Washington, that David Vitter was a frequent visitor to houses of ill repute. Now, he and Vitter obviously disliked each other intensely. But if not for Vincent Bruno, I think David Vitter might very well have ended up being governor of Louisiana, Bobby.
I think you're right. Now, I have to say, I have some fealty to David Vitter. David Vitter nominated me to West Point back in 2003. So before I say anything else, you know, thank you, Congressman Ben Vitter, for nominating me to West Point. But, I think that Vincent had a lot to do with a lot that happened in Louisiana politics. Some of it was in front of the curtain, and some of it was behind the curtain. But he was a guy who knew the right strings to pull and win. And for people that he liked, he could be a great asset. And for people that he didn't, woe unto you. Yeah. As is, obviously, David Vitter paid that price.
And David Vitter, I've been critical of, but I'll say this. He was an able man, a brilliant fella. He was a Rhodes Scholar. Unlike John Kennedy, who paid his way to Oxford, David Vitter was a real Rhodes Scholar, as was Bobby Jindal and Bill Clinton. And he was a man who had great potential. As they say, he could have been a contender and quite possibly would have been the governor of Louisiana. And as it turned out, he did get in a runoff with John Bel Edwards, which he lost. And the prostitution issue is the one that ultimately enveloped him. David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. And Mr. Bob, Major Bobby Ragsdale is a personification of a great American. David Vitter on a talk show in New Orleans accused Vincent Bruno of being a thug and a liar, and Bruno threatened to sue him. And I have a copy of the apology. Vitter sent an apology by courier to Vincent's home to apologize. Otherwise, Vincent was going to sue him. And if I could say something real quick, you know, Vincent would call me quite often, and he'd say, you know, Trump's president, and he would say something about Nancy Pelosi and Obama that wasn't flattering, and we'd get into a big shouting argument, and then he'd say, I got you. He would love getting me upset, and then we'd always end the phone call by saying we love each other.
Well, that was the kind of man Vincent Bruno was. And, you know, Vincent, as you say, Bobby, when he was loyal to somebody, he was loyal until the end. And he was loyal to Carlos Marcello, his uncle. He through the years, would defend Uncle Carlos quite dramatically when he was questioned about it.
He sure would. And that was one of the places where we didn't see eye to eye. You know, I would try to explain, like, this is the man is a criminal. He's a mob boss. Oh, you can't prove none of that. He didn't hurt any. He was the man of the community. Well, I mean, come on, Mr. Man. You know? But he just, you know, he was loyal to his family, and you know, it's hard to fault a man for that. And you know, in the same way, you know, lots of people in this town, I think, still revere the Marcellos in the same way that all the mob bosses there romanticized. And John Lafitte is a hero in New Orleans, and he was a pirate, right? So I think it's the same sort of a thing. I think he had a romantic vision of his uncle, which is hard to begrudge a man. You know, they were very close. That's all you could do. They were very close. But it is an interesting journey from Carlos Marcello's driver to head of the New Orleans Policemen's Union, and maybe that's a story in a sentence right there.
Well, Marcello, who lived in a tough world and obviously could have been taken out, he lived a very modest lifestyle. You could drive by his house. There was no gate around it. He was certainly accessible for anybody who wanted to do harm to him, but he lived a long life, and Vincent was with him until the end, and he would talk about Uncle Carlos, and as you say, it was sugar-coated, but it was sweet that he was loyal to people who had been kind to him. Now, Vincent was also an anti-vaxxer, and Bobby, unfortunately, that may have precipitated the end of his life.
I think it did, and I think that's pretty unfortunate. Somebody told me that he had a more broad anti-vax view. You know, I think there's two camps right now. There's the people who never trusted vaccines, and then there's the people who broadly support vaccines but feel leery about the current vaccine effort. Now, I want to be real clear, like, I work on this coronavirus problem for the Army, and the vaccine is safe and effective, and everybody should take it. I just want to be unequivocal about that. I wish that Vincent had taken it. I believe he'd be here with us, you know, he'd riled up about it. Happy to argue with me about it, but at least he'd be here. No, I think it's unfortunate. I think that many people are paying the price for ideological you know, I don't know what the right word is. They're married to their ideology, and it becomes a part of their identity, yeah. I think is what it is.
Yeah.
And it becomes, once it moves from a policy position to an identity position, it's impossible to back off of it without feeling like you are betraying yourself. And that's so unfortunate that we get tied up in our own egos about it. And a lot of people will probably be cross with me for saying that, but that's fine. You know, you gotta humble yourself sometimes to the information that's available. And I just wish that I had been able to convince Vincent of those things as well. You know, I should have tried harder, I guess.
Well, I'm sure you gave it your best shot. And he loved his wife. He lost a few years ago. And for those of us who are believers, I think Vincent led a good life and was kind to other people. And he is getting his just reward. Thank you, Major Ragsdale. A common sense conservative. It's a pleasure to talk with you. And we'll be calling again
soon. You too, my friend.
Thank you for your service to our country as well. Bronze Star winner,
you,
by
sir.
The way. Major Bobby Ragsdale. Thank you for joining us today. Be safe over the weekend. It's still a treacherous world out there, and we will be talking about it again next week. So until then, for Alonda Villarreal, thanks for listening, and stay tuned.